This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Good afternoon once again, everybody, and welcome to our customary Wednesday afternoon feature here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. It is the show trainers listen to, Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, my producer, Lee Delapina, broadcasting once again from our Lexington, Kentucky studios. And we do indeed welcome everybody tuning in throughout North America on Sirius XM and all of you joining us around the globe with our live streaming, always available at horseracingradio.net. I'm extremely excited for the show that we have planned for you here tonight. As always, we get to hear the life stories, the career stories of the people who dedicate themselves to the sport 365 days a year. And you know, I'm talking about the trainers. We begin today with trainer Tom Drury Jr., the 42-year-old who grew up in Louisville, Kentucky. And as the son of a trainer, racing was in his blood from a very young age. Tom, welcome to the show here tonight.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Mike.
Yeah, happy to have you with us. And, you know, it's funny, last week I visited with another Louisville native, Brad Cox, and we talked with trainer Dale Romans over the course of this program and so many other trainers who hail from the Derby City. Just kind of curious, did you run with any of those guys as you were growing up around the track?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I remember, I remember galloping horses at Churchill, and Dale was right across. I think at the time, he had four or five horses of his own. Of course, he was stabled there in his dad's barn, and we've all kind of came up together. I'm not quite as old as Romans is, but we all kind of grew up together around the backside of Churchill and whatnot, and known each other for years.
Is there kind of a kinship with the trainers that grew up in the Louisville area and grew up around the barns at Churchill?
I think so. We've kind of watched each other grow as we go along, and I think we've always always kind of been supportive of each other. So, you know, Dale certainly his career has just gone leaps and bounds since he started. I can remember years ago it wasn't uncommon to see Dale have a horse in the last race at Beulah Park maiden five at Turfway, and you know, now he's, you know, here's a guy that's considered to be one of the top trainers in the country. So it's been pretty exciting to kind of watch everybody get to the next level as they've, you know, as their careers have developed.
Who is your closest friend growing up or around the track at Churchill Downs? Is it a trainer that people would know today?
I don't know. I've always tried to kind of be friends with everybody. I would say probably Ralph Nix, who, you know, he was Bill Mott's assistant for years and years. He's got some horses in runs more on the Florida New York circuit now, but Ralph and I have always been very, very close, and of course he was a big part of helping me get my career started when he was Mott's assistant, and kind of getting my program set up, and he's another one that, you know, we're always rooting for and sure glad to see him being successful.
And I mentioned your dad was a trainer. Tell me a little bit more about your dad and his operation and growing up around the business, because obviously that was, as I said, in your blood from a very, very young age.
Yeah, my dad always, he never really got rolling the way he wanted to as a trainer. It was usually more he would have a horse or two that he trained, and then, of course, to supplement the income, he would gallop horses on the side. I can remember coming to Skylight Training Center, which is right outside of Louisville. My dad galloped here for years and years, and as a kid I kind of, you know, started like everybody else, you know, whether it was sweeping the aisleway or cleaning feed tubs or whatever, and kind of worked my way up that way. But he would always always seemed like he managed to come up with a horse or two that he would race himself and then gallop on the side, and which of course is, you know, when I turned 18 I got my trainer's license and did the same thing. I had a horse or two and was was galloping on the side, and you know, I was a little more lucky. I've probably been blessed with a few more opportunities than he's received, which has allowed me to now train full time. And it's something I think training horses, there's probably as much luck involved with it as far as getting the right clientele and things of that nature. I think, you know, there's a lot of trainers out there that do a great job that maybe don't get the opportunities that they deserve.
Well, and at the time that you took out your trainer's license at that very young age of 18, you were the youngest licensed trainer in the state of Kentucky. What was that like being the new kid on the block?
Well, I looking back on it, I wish I knew then what I know now. But it was just something I'd set a goal for myself, and it was pretty special to me just to, you know, to go ahead and get that taken care of. I remember taking the trainer's test. Of course, when I was 18, I looked like I was about 14, and I still remember Bernie Heddle, the state steward, kind of looking at me over his glasses when I went in to take the test. But it was something that I was very proud of to get that accomplished at a young age. Didn't have the kind of success I had hoped to early on, but it was certainly a big deal for me.
Yeah, interesting to hear you say that you wish you knew now or then what you know now. Hindsight always 20/20. Did you make a lot of mistakes when you were starting out, Tom?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I actually just ran into, I claimed a horse when I was 18 years old, and I ran into the owner of that horse just recently at Churchill, and you know, we were kind of laughing and cutting up about it. And I said, boy, I said, if you'd had a good horse trainer, you'd have probably won some races with that horse. And, you know, not that I didn't know, but yet I think training horses is one of those things that, you know, you do it every day and you learn every day. You're learning new tricks and different ways of going about it. And, you know, I think a big thing that I try to focus on right now is I try to treat each horse as an individual and cater to their individual needs. And I think, you know, just little things that you pick up along the way, it's, you know, it's just something that you really don't know until you see it, you deal with it, and you move on and you know better next time.
You know, you're obviously somebody that can laugh at themselves, and you tell that story just a moment ago. How important is it to have that sense of humor when you're training horses?
Well, it's one of those things you can look back and laugh on it. At the time, it's usually not nearly as funny. But you know, you've got to be willing to think outside of the box sometimes, and you've got to be willing to try things and take chances. And you know, sometimes they're going to work. You're going to hit the home run with one, and you're going to really help one by trying something different. And other times, you know, the next horse, it's not going to help as much. And again, that just comes back to trying to figure your horse out, treat them as an individual, and cater to whatever individual needs that they may have.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, you grew up not necessarily wanting to be a trainer at first. It was more of the riding side that appealed to you, wasn't it?
It really did. I wanted to be a jockey in the worst kind of way. You know, like every other kid that wants to be a rider, I rode the side of the couch for many years when I was a kid. And the only problem I ran into was when it came time to actually be on the back of a horse, I just wasn't that good. And I knew I wasn't that good. I galloped horses for years and was able to work for some of the top trainers in the country. Bill Mott and Wayne Lucas when he was on top of the world and guys like that. And I was very blessed to have those opportunities. But as far as actually riding races, I just didn't feel like I was as talented as some of the other people that were coming up at the time, and just decided that training horses might be a little better fit for me at the time.
Well, the good part about riding the side of your couch is that you never lose, right?
That's it. That's it. Absolutely. Only fell off once. That's it.
Who was your favorite jockey growing up? Did you have one that you looked up to?
Cordero, without a doubt. Yeah, Angel Cordero was, I think every kid growing up in horse racing, you know, it was either Cordero or Pinkai, and I was a Cordero man, without a doubt.
Would you pretend that you were Angel Cordero when you were riding on the couch?
Oh, no question.
Yeah.
No question. You know, you had to get, Angel always had that, you know, he was such a strong rider, and, you know, you'd always see the pictures of him with his arms stretched all the way out and, you know, just pushing a horse for all they were worth. And And that may have caused me to fall off the side of the couch. Actually, I'm trying to reach out just a little too far.
how about today? Is there a jockey that you say, "Wow, this guy he's pretty cool. I like him, or I like his style, or whatever it might be."
You know, there's a lot of them. I've just got all the respect in the world for Garrett Gomez. The things that he's been through, and to make it back to compete at the level that he competes at, and hearing bits and pieces of his story, and to just totally hit rock bottom and then come back as strong as he has. I certainly have all the respect in the world for him. I think he's one of the most talented riders in the world right now. Julian Leperu, he was to be able to have him around Turfway Park even for a short time. I felt like we were certainly blessed to have him as an option to be able to use, and watching him early on, it's been a lot of fun to watch his career develop. And I guess if I didn't mention Brian Hernandez, he'll probably shoot me, so I guess I better throw him out there too.
Yeah, one of the most underrated riders in the game, in my opinion.
I don't think there's any question. The thing about Brian is he works so hard. He's out every morning and, never says a word about it. He comes to the training center occasionally and works horses for me, and just one of those guys that he's really done everything he can to get his career to the next level, and I think he's certainly headed that way.
Talking with trainer Tom Drury Jr. on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So when you finally came to terms with the fact that, okay, I'm not going to be a jockey, was it an immediate transition to being a trainer, or were there some other things you thought about doing within the sport or maybe outside of the sport?
No, I pretty much set my sights on being a trainer. I've always wanted to be in the industry. When I decided I wasn't going to make it as a rider, I pretty much just, okay, well, that's fine. Then, I want to be a trainer. And then I just focused my sights towards, towards trying to figure out a niche in the business more than anything. When you're 18, 20 years old and you got a couple of horses and, you're galloping and living week to week, it doesn't really matter. But as I got older, it started to, you start thinking about your future a little bit. And, I think the big thing for me personally was I was able to find a little bit of a niche to where it allowed me to be successful in the industry, but it's also allowed me to still continue training, and that's doing the training center work that I do as far as working with other trainers and legging up young horses and things of that nature. So,
I want to talk to you about that in just a minute, but I want to go back and ask you about the time you spent working with Frankie Brothers as well. What was that experience like, Tom?
It's funny. I can remember telling Frankie just a few months ago, I truly thought he was the toughest human being on the face of the earth to work for at the time.
And really?
I joke with him now that, I look back on that and I realize he saw a little something in me and was maybe a little tougher on me than he might have been on some other people. It's kind of a joke with us now. I always tell him I sound just like him walking around the barn.
That's got to be a great compliment to him, though, isn't it?
Well, I sure hope it is. Frankie's been a huge part of my career in helping me get things to the next level. Madcap Escapade was, she was the first grade one winner that I was ever associated with that as far as helping to leg up. And of course, Frankie trained her and numerous other stakes horses, he gave me an opportunity to work with. And he's, the thing about Frankie is I always call him my lifeline. Frankie's one of those guys that I can pick up the phone anytime and call and say, "Hey, listen, I need a little advice on, whether it's a horse issue or even a personal issue." He's that kind of person, and just a class act and an excellent horseman.
Will you do that often? Pick up the phone and call Frankie?
Actually, he usually comes out on Saturday mornings, so I don't have to call him a whole lot. He's semi-retired. He still buys some young horses, but I'm still working closely with him and the clientele that he's associated with. I always joke that he's the best assistant in the country, and he usually comes out on Saturday mornings, hangs out for a little while, and And again, you know, just a pretty good lifeline to have around if you do have a question on something.
Why was he so difficult to work for at that time? I know you were very young, but why was he so difficult to work for?
Well, I don't think it was so much he was difficult as much, you know, if Frankie's one of them guys, if he tells you to be at the barn at 4:45, you need to be standing there at 4:44 and
yep.
Not 10 after 5. you know, just things of that nature. And, he would get on horses himself, and he knew he knew when we were paying attention and when we were doing our job correctly, and he knew when we weren't. And it wasn't so much that he was tough, but he wasn't afraid to call you out when you weren't taking care of business.
And you've taken a lot of that and incorporated it into what you're doing now as well?
Absolutely. My programs is whether it's Bill or Frankie or some of the guys that I've been blessed to work for, I try to take a little bit of each of their program and, you know, put that into my program, and we've been able to find a little success doing that.
You mentioned the niche that you've been able to kind of fall into here. I'm curious as to how all that came about. Of course, we're talking about Skylight Training Center in Goshen, Kentucky, which is really not all that far from Louisville. Talk about that niche and how this all came together, Tom.
It was actually kind of a fluke thing. A guy called me about it, and it was one of those friend of a friend kind of deals. A guy called me and asked me about helping him leg up a couple of babies, and I yeah, sure, absolutely. And we got the babies going and got them to a point, and ended up when they were ready to go to his trainer ended up being Bill Mott. And I sent the horses into Churchill to Ralph Nix, who I'd mentioned. I've known Ralph years and years, and He was happy with the horses and felt like they were where they were supposed to be and did things the right way. And he kind of mentioned, you know, we may have another one to come your way. And, you know, the following year I got two or three horses for Bill. And the following year I got a half a dozen for Bill. And, you know, and it just kind of, we did it in baby steps, but it just kind of kept going the right way for us.
Yeah, and it really went the right way with a big, almost white-looking gray by the name of Hansen, who went on to be the juvenile champion after winning the 2011 Breeders' Cup Juvenile at Churchill Downs. That was part of a undefeated two-year-old season. And a lot of people are going to forget, Tom, that you're responsible for getting him started when he was on the farm with you.
Yeah, we had we actually got Hansen. He was broke here in Odom County at Land of Goshen Farm. And once they got the kinks out of him, they sent him here to me. We had him for quite a while. Hansen was always, from day one, Hansen was such a high-energy horse. You know, you were always trying to kind of, you knew there was certainly a level of talent there, but you were always trying to kind of keep it to where you wanted it. And, you know, he was one of those horses, whether you were jogging or galloping or even breezing, Hansen always wanted to do just a little bit more than you wanted him to do. And, you know, I've got to credit Dr. Hansen for being patient with him early on. And I had to make more than one phone call of, you know, this horse acts like he can run a little bit, but we need to, you know, kind of continue to try to channel this a little bit and just keep him, you know, I'm afraid if we move forward too much too quick that, you know, we're going to lose him mentally, which very easily could have happened with a horse like him. I'd love to be able to take all the credit. I think Mike Maker just did a fantastic job of doing exactly what I just mentioned of keeping him, you know, keeping him contained and happy and getting along with him. And, you know, he's one of those horses that he was just a brilliant horse on the racetrack, but he was one that made you earn your money. He made you work for it.
You know, I can imagine that your emotions must go several different directions when you have a horse the quality of Hansen that you spend so much time with and you put all the efforts into him, and then the horse goes to another operation, another trainer, and goes on to these championship levels. What's that like, Tom? Is it rewarding? Is it frustrating? What's that like?
It's actually rewarding. And, the big thing for me is, when I first started training, you know, I was 20, 21 years old. I was just hoping I could figure out a way to make a living in this business. And, you know, if you'd have told me then I was going to be associated with a horse that was going to win the Breeders' Cup and be named two-year-old champion, I'd have told you were nuts. So for me, it's been, it's been very rewarding. I mean, I kind of consider myself to be a little bit of maybe a high school basketball coach. You know, I'm not getting them to the pros, but I'd like to think that we're a big part of teaching them the basic lessons and being a part of heading them in that direction.
Yeah, maybe a little bit like being a proud father and watching your child excel.
That's it. Absolutely. That's it. Yeah.
And of course, he goes on not just to the Breeders' Cup, but goes to the Kentucky Derby in 2012. And being from Louisville, what was it like to see him going into the starting gate on the first Saturday in May?
Oh, it was huge. It's one of those things that, it's one of those things you dream about, you know, just being associated with a horse like that. I certainly didn't expect this early on, and you know, I've always been pretty realistic, and I know, you know, to get a horse to the Derby, I mean, that's we've been watching people try to buy Derby winners and raise them and everything else, and for me to be able to say I was associated one, it was pretty special. You know, we were all rooting for him. Unfortunately, it didn't work out, but it was a pretty special moment for us.
Were you in favor of painting his tail blue?
I left that one up to Doc. If they would have been okay with it, I would have been fine with it. I don't know that it's something I would have wanted to have done if I'd been training him, but I was good with it. If the racing commission would have allowed it, I would have been fine with it.
Hey, you know, it's interesting. And by the way, talking with Tom Drury Jr. on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton, you obviously have a great knack for working with young horses and breaking them and training them and getting them ready to go to other trainers and other operations. But you also have a great knack for training horses yourself, and you've been part of some really nice horses in your own barn. Talk about some of those.
Timeless Fashion, without a doubt, he was the first horse I got that I kind of consider him to be my next level horse. And we ended up winning 7 stakes with him overall, and he was just such a special horse to us. He was actually sent to me originally with the idea that he was going to probably go to Bill Mott, and we got him started. And of course, he ended up not running until he was a 4-year-old, and it was never anything major, but we just hit some bumps in the road. And the Judy Miller, she's just a wonderful lady. She decided to leave him with me and let me have an opportunity to race him. And he ended up running, I believe, through his 7-year-old year, and we ended up winning 7 stakes with him. But for me personally, that's probably the biggest question I've always asked myself is, you know, if had I been training Hanson, would he have won the Breeders' Cup? If I'd have had Madcap Escapade to continue on, would I have won the Ashland with her? And Timeless Fashion kind of gave me a lot of self-confidence, because it just showed me that I could train a next level horse when, you know, if given the opportunity.
Yeah, and it has to be a great confidence booster for you, and really a great endorsement to your program to know that you're doing things in a fashion that work.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Now, you generally stick pretty close to the Kentucky circuit. You may go up to Ohio or Indiana, but you don't venture far from home, is that right?
No, I don't. It's probably cost me some horses, you know, at times. But I've got an operation here at the training center. We usually keep between 40 and 60 horses, depending on the time of year. And this is what feeds my family. And I feel like I need to kind of be pretty close to the training center. So I'm not afraid to take a horse out of town, if they need to go. But as far as actually, you know, setting up shop and traveling and things of that nature, I just don't have any desire to do that. I'm pretty content doing what I'm doing.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you ever got the itch to take a shot on circuits like New York or Florida or any of those type of circuits.
Well, if the right opportunity came along, I don't know that I would run from it, but I'm not going out of my way to do that. I'm pretty happy. I mean, gosh, I feel like I'm so blessed. I mean, some of the, you know, the clientele that I've been fortunate enough to be able to deal with, and some of the horses that go through here now, it's a lot of fun just doing what we're doing, and to go messing with that. I just don't know that that's something I want to go out of my way to do.
So are you spending more time now working with the young horses on the farm or with the horses that you actually have in training?
It's just a nice combination.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure how many I've got in the barn right now that I would actually be racing myself. I'm sure it'd be somewhere between 15 and 20, but it's a nice combination. I'm able to go to the races and enjoy racing horses, and Occasionally, you know, if a horse isn't going to do in like a Mott's program, he might give me an opportunity to run a horse, and it allows me to, you know, to not only run horses, but to be able to run horses for better clientele and to be associated with, you know, some of the better owners in the country. And you know, if I wasn't doing what I'm doing here at Skylight, I probably wouldn't receive that opportunity.
Tom, I always like to kind of wrap up the interviews by asking trainers what other hobbies they have outside of horse racing and some things that people might not know about Tom Drury Jr. What would you tell people?
Love the water. I got a couple of wave runners, and that's usually if I in the summertime, if I'm not at the barn, you can usually find me on the water somewhere. Love to be outside and, you know, more of an outdoors type person. But that's really about it. Usually seems like there's plenty to do around the training center. And, you know, I love winning races. That's probably my number one hobby. If I can win races, then that's where I'm at.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing. You really can't describe the thrill to somebody who hasn't been part of it. It's hard to really describe that feeling of winning a race, either from an owner perspective or a trainer perspective or a rider's perspective. There's really nothing like it.
No, well, there's not. For anyone that's been in the business for any length of time, they know the ups and downs that comes along with being involved in horses, and you learn real quickly that to really enjoy the wins and the good moments, because they're, you know, sometimes they can be far and few between, and it's such a process to get a horse to the races and to get over the hump of the things that can go wrong and the letdowns that you may deal with along the way. So yeah, when they do win, it's a pretty special feeling.
What advice would you give to a young person that comes up to you and says, "Hey, I'm thinking about getting into training horses"? What would be the one thing you would tell them?
Call Todd Pletcher. Call Todd Pletcher, see if he needs a hot walker. Absolutely. Pay attention, be the first one to the barn every morning, be the last one to leave, and if you get a chance to go over some horses with Todd himself, that's even all the better. And find the strongest outfit in the country and pay your dues and try to work your way up.
You know, I can tell you a quick Todd Pletcher story. A couple of years ago, we were at Palm Meadows, and we were waiting to talk with Todd to do an interview, and he was sending a set out, and he must have had, I think, six horses all lined up, ready to go. And he went down, and he felt the legs of each and every one of them, and then the exercise riders came out from across the shed row from another room and came out in single file as if they were coming out of the jocks room, and he gave them a leg up and out they went. It was the most efficient, incredible display that I've ever seen at any barn.
Yeah, there's no question. And I know a lot of that goes back to Wayne and, you know, the way that he originally set his program up. I think a lot of people are still trying to kind of simulate, you know, what Wayne's program was back in his heyday. But yeah, Todd, we've been lucky enough to have a few horses for Todd, and, you know, I've been able to talk to him on the phone a few times, and, believe me, you can ask Todd anything about any of his horses, and he's going to tell you to a T what's going on with them. He's got a memory like no other, and my hat's off to him. Anybody that can run an operation like he runs and do it with the organization and the success that he does it with, you know, I've got all the respect in the world for him.
Well, Tom, this has been an absolute delight to visit with you tonight on Trainer Talk, to hear your story and so many of the great moments you've been part of throughout your career. Thank you so much for taking the time. All the best moving forward in 2014 and beyond.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed being here, and I sure appreciate you guys having me.
All right, Tom Drury Jr. here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Should have asked him, cats or cards? Always a good question for somebody from Louisville. We'll get to the second half. Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, next on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Fasig Tipton.
Where will you be this summer? The Fasig Tipton 2014 yearling sales will be here before we know it, so make plans now. The July sale in Lexington, Kentucky will be held July 14th. In 2013, the sale boasted an average of more than $89,000 and a median of $72,000, and the percentage rate of return of 43% was the third highest of any yearling sale in North America. The Saratoga sale on August 4th and 5th is always one of the top international yearling marketplaces. The Lansdale's $295,000 average in 2013 maintains its leadership role, and with the highest percentage of profitable yearlings among all sales in North America this past year, it's the only place to be this August. New York bred yearlings are in the spotlight August 9th and 10th in Saratoga with a $430,000 average and major increases in both average and median in 2013. The New York bred sale is the most productive auction for the cream of the New York bred crop. So where will you be this summer?
This is Daily Racing Form's Dan Ullman with some big news about DRF bets. Thousands of players like you have already made the switch to DRF bets, and now there's an even bigger reason for you to join. Free DRF PPs. That's right, for the first time ever, get free Daily Racing Form PPs when you wager with DRF bets. These are the DRF past performances you know and love, and DRF bets is the only place you can get them free. So why wager anywhere else? With DRF bets, you'll get the best sign-up bonus in the business, free guides and analysis from DRF's top handicappers, breaking news, analysis, and wagering on the go with DRF and DRF Bets Mobile, one-click multi-ticket wagers with DRF Ticketmaker, and now free Daily Racing Form PPs. Only one place gives you the PPs you prefer when you wager, DRF Bets. Join today and wager with the most trusted name in racing. And if you sign up right now, you'll get a $125 cash bonus. Find out more at drf.com/bets. That's drf.com/bets.
HRRN Live brings you live racing from tracks across the country. Join Chad Summers and the HRRN broadcast team as we bring you live racing every Wednesday through Friday, 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern on our new channel, XM208, or streaming live online at horseracingradio.net. HRRN Live is your source for live thoroughbred racing from coast to coast, only on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Go to hrrnlive.com for a complete schedule of tracks and races.
This is Al Stahl, and you're listening to Horse Racing Radio Network.
This is the Horse Racing Radio Network, your home for racing's biggest events.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, coming to you from our Lexington, Kentucky studios. My producer, Lee Delapina, pushing all the buttons and getting ready for another fun interview here. Really excited about talking with our next guest here this afternoon. He is 39 years old. He is a native of East Liverpool, Ohio. He began training horses on his own right around 2008, and since that time has recorded 121 career victories. His runners have earned more than $5 million in purses, and that's due in large part to his Belmont Stakes winner and champion, Summer Bird. You know I'm talking about trainer Tim Ice. Tim, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Mike. Appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's interesting, Tim, when you look back year by year at the statistics that are listed on Equibase for you, they're extremely consistent. You had $540,000 in purses last year, $685,000 in 2012, $674,000 in 2011, and $484,000 in 2010. And then, boom, you come back to 2009, $2.9 million in purse earnings. Only your second year of training and really your first full year, that's the way to get your career off on the right foot, my friend.
Yes, it is. You know, if you take Summer Bird out, it's still right there at $600,000 because, you know, you earned $2.3 million of that. So I was very fortunate to have a horse like Summer Bird in 2009.
Yeah, I'm sure you could never imagine it this way, but if you were to write the script as to how I would want to start my career, any trainer, I mean, this, it couldn't have gotten off in a better direction for you.
No, I never dreamed so early. You know, you always dream eventually you get there, but in my first full year of training, to have a horse like that and be on a national stage where I was with him, it was surreal. So it definitely makes you appreciate the years that you don't have a horse like that, but it was a fun year. A lot of things, you know, were changing, and what a fun horse Summer Bird was just to be around. I was the biggest fan of him as I was training him. So it was just fun watching him race.
Yeah, that's the thing a lot of people don't realize when we talk about trainers. They just see the trainers come over with the horse in the afternoon and they saddle the horse. Maybe some people come out and watch him work out in the mornings. But they don't realize how much of a fan so many trainers become of horses that are in their care, and even horses that aren't their own horses that they're training. You really do become a fan first and foremost, don't you?
Right. You know, I mean, I can look back at running in the Breeders' Cup when we ran against Zenyatta, you know, and it was just, you know, the horses in that race, Giapponi twice over, you know, obviously Zenyatta and Summer Bird in there, and you just become a fan, and we're all in it. We love horses. We love horse racing, and it gives you a chance to sit back and be a fan and just be amazed by these horses and what they do for us.
Well, let's go back to the beginning, Tim. Tim Ice joining us on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. East Liverpool, Ohio, let's face it, not exactly a hotbed for horse trainers. How did you become interested in racing?
Well, my mother and stepfather moved to Louisiana, and my stepfather was training horses at the time, and he was actually over at, it was Waterford Park when they met, and which is now Mountaineer Park, but the very first racetrack I'd been to was it was Waterford, but moved to Louisiana when I was 13. I just kind of fell into it. We had a little 10-acre farm there. We kept anything from broodmares to babies, yearlings, and two-year-olds, and so, you know, I developed a love for the horses, and it didn't come overnight. It was first when I was introduced to them, I was scared. but eventually, I mean, it was just a passion of mine as I was around them more and more that I knew it was something that I wanted to do. And right out of high school, I got a job on the racetrack and just followed it from there.
Yeah, what was that like for you? Especially in the beginning, you mentioned you were kind of scared of the horses and being around them. Look, they're big animals, and if you haven't worked with them up close, they can be pretty intimidating. What were those early days like, and how difficult was it for you to, you know, kind of overcome those things?
Well, I think it's mind over matter to overcome it. Realize that, you know, they're not out there trying to hurt you. They're as scared of you as you are of them, but it's one of those situations where you just start bonding with them, and that fear just subsides, and you appreciate the size of them. But, you know, early on, it was all I could do to get in the stall and feed a horse, but it didn't take long. Once I was around them for a while, it was just second nature going in and being around them and working with them. So
many trainers that have come on this show over the past year, Tim, have talked about having somebody in their life that was involved in the sport somehow, whether it was a father, a grandfather, they were a trainer, they were an owner. It doesn't sound like you had that type of an influence growing up.
Well, growing up, I had my stepfather. He was early on, you know. He didn't have a big stable. He had a few horses. He trained a few for John Franks, you know, and just kept a small stable. But it was good in a way where I could see how he was hands-on, and it kind of taught me to be hands-on. But as I, like I said, once I graduated high school and I went on, Keith DeSorma was a big influence. Cole Norman, whom I worked for a little while, and Morris Nix. Those are the four guys that I felt very instrumental into where I am in teaching me what I know.
Was working with Keith your first job around the track in terms of working with another trainer?
Keith was the first one, and, like, you know, I was out in California working for him. I moved out there in 94. And then working for him, I got the experience what what watching good races live out at Santa Anita, Hollywood, and Del Mar was all about. But he was the first one to be instrumental in where I'm at. But like I said, I think with my stepfather and DeSormo, Norman, and Morris Nix, all three of those guys to help me along the way.
Yeah, that DeSormo name is certainly famous in the sport, not just because of Keith, but because of his brother, Hall of Fame jockey Kent. And it's certainly famous in Louisiana, but around the globe as well. What was that like being able to hang out with the DeSormos every day and to learn from Keith?
It was a lot of fun. Keith, he's very hands-on himself. I learned a lot from him just being around him, and then that's where I met Kent when I was out there. And, there's a lot of horse knowledge between those two guys. And so there's a lot to learn as long as you were willing to take it in. And it was a big part of going on and knowing this was exactly what I wanted to do, was learning from guys like that.
So after you worked with Keith, you went to Cole Norman next, if I'm not mistaken. Was it immediate, or was there a little bit of a break in between?
No, I actually left Keith and went to work for Cole. And Cole, he's a top trainer in the South, Louisiana Downs and Oaklawn. I wanted to get knowledge from a few different guys, things that I could bring into my training program. And that was the reason that I went to work for Cole, was, you have a leading trainer that has an abundance of horses and how to maintain them and keep them all in peak performance. And so with that, I went to work for Cole and had had a lot of great learning experiences with Cole.
And then what led to the decision to go work with Morris Nix after that?
Morris was kind of old school. He did a lot of things that I thought would benefit me in finding out and learning how to do certain things. And Morris is a great guy. Probably, I'd say one of the best guys that I worked for. Very, very smart horseman.
Talking with trainer Tim Ice here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So you do your apprenticeship, so to speak, with Keith DeSormo, Cole Norman, and Morris Nix. And what led to the decision to finally say, hey, I want to try this on my own? And how difficult was it to make that jump?
It was a little scary. The decision to go out on my own was, I wasn't getting any younger. I had 15 years under three different guys. And so, I wanted to give it a try. And I was 34 when I went out on my own, that it was one of those where I'm not too old to try it, and I'm not too old if I don't make it to go get another job. But it was something that I talked over with Morris, and Morris told me, he felt that I was ready, and I thought I was ready, so I just jumped in. And it's always scary when you move on and do something, and you don't have that check coming in every week. So needed to have results and needed to have good clients, and I was fortunate.
Well, yeah, that changed relatively quickly for you. And we're going to talk more about Summer Bird here in just a minute. But what was your very first winner that you sent out, Tim?
It was a horse, actually, for Dr. J. Arman, named Amber Star. He was a gelding. And I believe it was a maiden $7,500 race, and he paid $109, I believe, to win.
Wow. Wow. How'd you celebrate that night?
I I can't remember how I celebrated, but I can tell you I was pretty excited.
Yeah, well, that's one heck of a celebration if you can't remember how you did it.
Yeah. He was one of those big horses who it was only his second start of his life. I called Dr. J after the race and I told him we won, and he was on an airplane just landing, and I said, well, he must have paid a lot of money. And I said, well, $109, but he got to be pretty good in his first race.
Did you bet on him that day?
I did not. I'm not a big gambler. Money's hard to earn. I don't want to give it away.
Well, it wasn't long after that that along came your first stakes winner, right?
Right. At Oakland Park, and I think it was in March or April, with a fellow named Affirm Truth, also for the Dr. J. Armans.
Yeah, Firm Truth winning the, I believe, was it the Rainbow Miss Stakes? Was that it?
Correct, the Rainbow Miss.
Yeah.
For Arkansas bred fillies.
Yeah, was that as exciting or maybe more exciting than even winning your first race? How would you compare the two?
Well, obviously, you know, I mean, your first win is exciting, but your first stakes win is, I think it tops your first win, but it was pretty exciting.
Well, you know, this is a game that has its highest highs, has the lowest lows. We hear that all the time. And you've certainly had your share of ups and downs with the game already in a very brief career. On February 9th, 2010, 3 weeks after you attended the Eclipse Awards to see Summer Bird be named champion three-year-old, your big owners, the Jayaramans, decided to transfer their stable, including Summer Bird, to trainer Tim Ritchie. How hard was that on you, Tim?
It was like losing a kid. The bond that I developed with Summer Bird, I would have to say he's like a child to me, but it was very hard. Also, you know, being around the business, you know, things like that, they happen, you know, and it did. I'm not the first one that it happened to. I wouldn't be the last one that it happened to. You know, and all I wanted to do, I wanted to see Summer Bird and go on and be as successful no matter who had him. I obviously loved the horse and I owed everything to him. But, you know, it was very, very hard.
Yeah, I can't imagine the feeling of watching your big horse walk out of the barn. It's got to just crush you, doesn't it?
It did. You know, I mean, it was devastating. But, you know, and the thing was, I said I could either let it, you know, ruin me or I can try to rebuild my stable and look for the next one. You know, but the biggest thing was getting back to work and trying to rebuild a stable that I had just lost pretty much all of my horses.
Yeah, really, your stable had been decimated. You were down to just six horses at that point. Did you get depressed?
No. I mean, I didn't let it get me down like that. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it was hard watching him walk out of the barn. But, you know, I mean, in this business, you're thankful for what you have today. And knowing that it could be here today and gone tomorrow, you know, it's one of those things where I couldn't let it just get me down where I was unable to be productive for the clients that did stay with me.
Yeah, and of course, unfortunately, Summer Bird never raced again after leaving your barn. Did that bother you?
That he never raced again?
Yeah.
The only thing that I wanted was for him to be 100% if they ever ran him again. I think the decision when they retired him was in his best interest. So I wanted to see him be as successful in the stallion barn as he was on the racetrack. So I didn't wish them any hardship when they retired him. You know, I called the Jayaramans and wished them the best in the breeding shed with him and with the other horses. I don't hold any hard feelings towards anybody.
Yeah, you handled it beautifully with the media and publicly as well. So you're to be commended for that. What did you learn, Tim, from going through that experience? And how did you go about rebuilding the stable to get to where you are now?
Well, you know, I mean, it's one of those things, like I said, when you're in the business long enough, and even though it was just my first year of training, that you know things like this happens, that you can never count on anything long term. And it just seems like more and more where the horses switch barns and things like that. But the biggest thing that I learned is you appreciate what you have every day. And it's something that you don't take for granted. But as far as rebuilding my stable, you know, I tried to use a little bit of Summerbird's success. I picked up a few horses for short leaf stables, which is John Ed Anthony, and I went to New York that summer, and you know, did okay up in New York. I just didn't have the type of horses that could compete up there.
You know, one thing we hear a lot in the breeding side of the game is that if a stallion doesn't produce runners early, they're really up against it. Well, you came onto the training scene. You immediately showed that you could train a good horse, obviously, with Summer Bird. Did that help when you did have to rebuild? You said you kind of used some of that momentum. Did it help you? Did you see a bump from that?
Well, you know, I think it helped me a little bit. You know, and I think whereas he was able to help me, I still needed to prove myself with other horses too. So, you know, you can only live off the success of one horse for so long, and you have to have success with the others. So it helped a little bit, but I still needed to prove with the other horses that I had what kind of job I could do.
Well, walk back through that magical run that you had in 2009 with Summer Bird. He finishes fourth in his debut, then he comes back and wins his second start, and from there, it was just onward and upward. Talk about his career a little bit.
Yeah, he came in to me on January the 8th of 2009, and you know the Dr. Javins told me that they had a really nice two-year-old turning three that they was going to send to me at Oaklawn. When he came in, it was one of those, we thought he was going to be a nice horse. How special, you know, I mean, we didn't put any standards on how good we thought he was going to be until we ran him in the Arkansas Derby, is just what type of caliber of horses he'd run against. But his first start was going 6 furlongs. We had talked about it. We said it's going to be a little bit short, but we'd rather just give him a race to kind of use as a learning experience for him. And then, you know, his second start, he jumped up in one going a mile and 16th. You know, and we discussed the Arkansas Derby and threw it around and thought, you know, if we could get in that race, let's try him. And he ran such a beautiful race that day that, you know, we weren't sure whether we'd get in the Kentucky Derby. It was one of those last hour phone calls that we got that said, hey, your horse is going to make it in, that decided we was going to go.
What's that like when you get that call?
But it was exciting because honestly, like I had talked to Dr. Jarman's and we had said if we don't hear anything by today, we were just going to train him, get him ready for the Lone Star Park Derby that they had a week after the Kentucky Derby, and then try to use that as a stepping stone towards the Belmont Stakes. So when they finally called us and said, hey, your horse is going to make it in, and I believe it was Steve Haskins that called me and let me know that, you know, now was the time you start getting busy because all the preparations of getting him up to Churchill, what we needed to do, it was obviously everybody's first experience with the Derby in the summer boat camp. So it was exciting, but it was a lot of work trying to get him there and do the right things by him.
What do you remember about that week, talking about Derby week?
It was very busy. you know, lots of media around. For me, I was more concerned with Summerbird, how he was going to handle everything. You know, going into the Kentucky Derby, he only had three races. Now you're throwing him into a media blitz where, you know, you don't know how he's going to handle the crowd and everybody that's going to be around. So I tried to just focus on him and not everything around us.
And of course, he ends up finishing sixth, 43-1, ran a very credible race. You had to be thrilled with that performance. You skip the Preakness, and then you go on to the Belmont Stakes. He's 11-1 in the Belmont. He gets up. He wins it by 2 3/4 lengths. But you kind of went back to your roots a little bit, going to Mr. Hall of Famer Kent DeSormo for your rider.
Yeah, the decision to put Kent on him was probably about 2 weeks before the Belmont. He had worked him, and I thought those two just worked beautifully together. The way that he responded to Kent and how Kent responded to him. So I wanted to go to Kent just because of the relationship that I had with him when I was in California working for his brother. But, you know, it was nice to be able to watch Kent redeem himself, per se, you know, from the year before. But I never thought that it was Kent's fault on Big Brown. It was just nice to have Kent on Summerbird that he was able to get the win that year.
Yeah, do you just kind of pinch yourself? I mean, here's a kid growing up in East Liverpool, Ohio, kind of scared to be around horses when you get started, and all of a sudden, your first full year of training, you're winning an American Classic. Do you just kind of pinch yourself every once in a while?
Oh, most definitely, you know, and it was one of those moments, even after the race, you know, you're thinking, man, I just won the Belmont Stakes, and usually I'm sitting at home watching it on the television, so it was very, very exciting.
Trainer Tim Ice, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Tim, only a few minutes left here before we have to wrap it up. It's kind of flown by, but do want to ask you your favorite Summerbird moment. What would it be?
I think it was having him up at Saratoga, you know, getting him ready for the Travers and winning the Travers. He showed so much class and just the way he took everything in. And one of my favorite things about Summerbird was how he responded to people. He loved people. He loved his photograph taken. Anybody could come up and stand next to him and take their photograph. And like he responded so well to the love that he was given by everybody.
Well, he responded well, and you responded well with the media the entire way as well. So I can personally thank you for that. You were very accommodating through the entire process and very accommodating here tonight as well. Tim, I always like to wrap up by asking trainers to let us know something that people might not know about them, maybe something you like to do outside of racing, some hobbies you have, or other sports that you follow.
I'm a big football fan, Pittsburgh Steelers. I think probably most people probably saw me wearing Steelers hats around the time I had Summerbird, but big football fanatic, and so that's where I'm usually at football season is Sunday watching the games.
Yeah, Tim, you just became my favorite trainer ever on Trainer Talk because I am a diehard Steeler fan. My producer Lee Delapina is as well, so you've become our number one trainer ever on Trainer Talk.
That's good to know.
We'll have to hook up at Heinz Field one of these days.
Sure. I went to the Detroit Lions game at Heinz Field when we won this year.
Yeah, well, you got to see a good one then.
Yep.
Trainer Tim Ice, my special guest here on Trainer Talk. Tim, again, can't thank you enough look forward to seeing more of your runners in the winner's circle coming up here soon, and all the best moving forward 2014 and beyond.
Thanks a lot, Mike. I appreciate it.
All right, appreciate it. Trainer Tim Ice, go Steelers. Absolutely. Always nice to catch up with Tim. Great stuff. Summerbird, one of the best. Did a heck of a job with him. All right, Trainer Talk, all presented by Fasig Tipton. You can go to FasigTipton.com to learn more about our sponsor here on the Horse Racing Radio Network and check out all their sales coming up throughout the year. Been a fun show. For my producer, Lee Delapina, I am Mike Penna. We will talk to you next time. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.